Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
What's up?
We have talked about a lot of things recently, because we talk about something pretty much every week. So check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've recently talked about It Follows. We did a video podcast on The Graduate. We talked about Clueless before that, Casablanca before that, and Furious 7 before that. And just continuing on with that very clear line through all those topics, The Most Violent Year was the episode previous to that. Check that out, themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. Let's just get right to it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yep.
What are we talking about here today?
We are talking about the relatively new film, Ex Machina.
Yes. Yes, it is relatively new, is a film.
the directorial debut of Alex Garland.
Yeah.
My second favorite Alex. I was a very big fan of 28 Days Later, which he wrote, and you were as well, I assume.
Yeah, no, I like that movie. I like Sunshine a lot, just except for the parts that everybody fucking hates about Sunshine. I didn't realize he wrote the screenplay to Never Let Me Go, which is another movie I liked a lot. I just found that out about 20 minutes ago. okay. But yeah, he is a man who I've been conscious of pretty much as long as I've been conscious of people that make movies. Like, I remember his name being a talking point when The Beach came out, which is another movie I saw, even though I didn't like that very much.
Right. Yeah, and I like someone who is not a particularly big zombie movie fan at all. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was a very well done movie. And in recommending this movie to people, which I have been doing a lot with Ex Machina, I just give the caveat that it is sci-fi, but it's not the, you know, aliens fighting in space kind of action-y sci-fi. It's a very slower, kind of pensive sci-fi, which I think is the, analogous to the way 28 Days Later was. It got away from a lot of the tropes, and I thought made it a much more interesting entry into the genre, and I feel the same way about Ex Machina.
Yeah, and also, 28 Days Later is a bit different. 28 Days Later was more of an action movie than Ex Machina is, and kind of had this one very distinct change to the zombie genre, which is that the zombies were fast, you know, like so that added an element of newness for the people that were already into zombies, and then the more thoughtful pontification about what are we going to do now that the world is ending, or you know, the world as we know it has ended, that sort of kept people like you and me entertained, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and so I really enjoyed Ex Machina. You recommended that I see it, so I'm pretty sure you enjoyed it as well.
Yeah,
but no, yeah, I didn't know a ton going into it, and I liked, that's always nice to kind of be surprised by something. And this movie, at least for me, kind of hooks you in really quickly. Like it starts and it's on pretty quickly. You know, it is kind of, as I said, a slower, not entirely action packed movie, but. You get the idea of what this movie's going to more or less be about in the first few minutes. Like, he wins a contest and then he's there, and then the movie is pretty much started.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, you are exactly right. You immediately started talking about one of the things that, that really caught me off guard about this movie. Alex Garland is an amazing director. Like, right out of the gate, it's probably not even a minute before we get into that helicopter with Caleb. But the way it establishes the world that he exists within, shows that he is now going to be exiting that world, and shows us that he and everybody around him is excited about this possibility, and that this is a very rare thing. It's 45 seconds to 60 seconds, maybe. But it's so well done, you know? And it's so snappily directed, and it's not imitation Fincher. It's not like type, quick cut, you know, like the Social Network was for so much of it. But it had that sort of confidence of, I'm going to tell you something, but I'm going to tell you very little about it, but you're smart enough to keep up with what is happening. And I'm going to think of everything you need to know, and I'm going to show you all of that in the most concise way, and I'm not going to use any dialogue at all. You know, and I don't know, that's the type of thing that will really grab me. Somebody that, for the first scene of their directorial debut, doesn't explain anything with dialogue, but still is able to explain everything that you need to know, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because this movie is, you know, as I said, Penso really gives a lot of moments time to breathe. And so, as you said, it's not Fincher. It's not just as quickly cut or as much, you know, Sorkin-y quick dialogue or something that you can pack into a movie. You're right. It's very efficient filmmaking. He does the things that are that can be done quickly. And then the things that you kind of, want to have more time with, some of the more meditative scenes, I think definitely have that room, to think and explore and things like that. So, yes, I will go with, I will agree that he is a very, very, there are tons of things I did like about this movie, but the direction is very much up there. I mean, I like Oscar Isaac. I like everybody in this movie, actor wise. The filmmaking is just incredible. And just looking into, you know, some things, just the mise-en-scène, like the just certain reflections, slowly moving cameras, showing off like power dynamics, and how much thought has just been put into the color scheme of this movie. It's just a very, mm-hmm. very, very, well put together movie with just tons of stuff packed in. And as I said, it's not that it's just throwing, dialogue and action at you nonstop. It's just very, very, deliberate filmmaking, and that there's so much meaning in everything about the setting, to the music, to the, as I said, the color choices. I think it's one of my favorite parts about this movie. It's just incredible how much stuff is in this movie that, you know, doesn't have a ton of dialogue, really.
Yeah, exactly. And even just talking on the purely stylistic elements of the film, obviously this is something I think about a lot because I'm somebody that cares a lot about directors and is always wants to see a new director that is very talented, because that's kind of, like I said, something I care about. And I was trying to think of the last director that really caught me off guard stylistically like that. And obviously there have been other good directors, many good directors that have shown up. Even we've talked about people like Derek Cianfrance, who did The Place Beyond the Pines, J.C. Shandor, who did A Most Violent Year, whose first film was Margin Call, David Robert Mitchell. But as far as somebody whose first film felt so confident and so well-directed, I couldn't think of anybody since Rian Johnson that really made me be like, oh my God, this is a director to watch, like immediately. And I thought that was really cool. It made me really excited. And the fact that the rest of the film did not fail to deliver on that promise continued to make me really happy, because this is, as we've said, a very, very good film.
Yeah, and I think he's someone who knows how talented he is in a good way. And, you know, just reading interviews with him about this movie, they said, it might be better if there's a fight scene or if the helicopter crashes at the end or, you know, all these things. And he said, you know, I would rather just have a smaller budget with less control. A smaller budget and have more control over this. You can keep the $10 million and I won't do this, you know, explosion scene, but you're also not going to tell me how to do all these other
things.
Said, no, I will, you know, forego the larger budget if I can make the movie that I want to make it. And I'll make, you know, a smaller movie that maybe appeals to less people, but the people who it does appeal to are really going to enjoy it. And I feel like I'm among that number of people who really did enjoy this movie. And because of reasons like that, where he just, everything, a visual spectacle, as I said, just to kind of let the ideas play out and make a more thoughtful movie. And I think it definitely succeeds in doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And he still has the helicopter. It just doesn't crash. I think that quote is actually,
yeah,
that quote's actually a direct reaction to how he felt about the way Sunshine turned out, which is that, and this is generally how pretty much everybody feels about the movie Sunshine. Well, everybody that saw it, incredible first third and first half of the second third, and then just totally off the rails. And when it goes off the rails is clearly where all the money was spent. Now there's some things in the beginnings that are there only because you have money to, but are interesting because of that. But you know, it probably still wasn't worth the trade-off. And Alex Garland has been very outspoken about how he feels that movie turned out. And when he did work with Danny Boyle, even from the days of The Beach, like Danny Boyle would bring him in on set and be basically just tell him, you know, what was happening in the filmmaking process and all of these things. And so Alex Garland really, on movies that he wrote and didn't direct, he was still aware of all of the problems that were coming up. And I mean, as a person, he can just watch the movie and try and see what goes wrong. And what goes wrong was in Sunshine was where they put all the money. And I think that what you're talking about is kind of a direct reaction to something that he has made or helped to make going awry specifically because they gave into the allure of more money, you know, and he didn't want to do that again.
Yeah. And I mean, as unfortunate as that is to kind of have a movie that could have been better, not reach its potential. If that's what it takes, I mean, if that was just his learning experience and now he knows just to do things his way and to make them smaller, but more representative of his vision, that's wonderful. I mean, because I would imagine the temptation of taking that money, you know, would be pretty powerful, especially someone who is, you know, relatively young in their career, or, you know, as this is his first directorial effort, you know, to kind of make a big splash, to make a lot of money, to get bigger jobs. It's great that he is, you know, that's not where his heart is. He just wants to make good movies for people who know how to watch good movies.
Yeah, exactly. And we are those people, and he made a good movie. So let's talk about it.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Where to begin, I suppose, is the first question.
How about the title?
Okay. I mean, I feel like this is more your purview. Yeah, this is your purview.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's called Ex Machina. Obviously, I think the first people think of is the phrase Deus Ex Machina, mm-hmm. which, you know, comes from old theater, Greek tragedies and things like that, where the play was basically, you know, Deus Ex Machina means God from the machine. So often a machine playing, you know, God would lower down from the top of the theater and, you know, lift the main character out of peril. And, you know, that became kind of a trope, and some people criticize it, some people like it. But I think it's a very interesting title because, you know, we have just the machine. We have, you know, God has been removed from the equation. Yeah. And there's definitely some talk about God, you know, playing God in this movie. Actually one of the funnier parts of this movie. There are like five very funny parts to this otherwise extremely serious movie. And Nathan paraphrasing Caleb about calling him a God, I think, is one of them. And, you know, I just kind of like that idea that we've kind of moved past God, and, you know, it seems to be that we're on the precipice of the singularity, that it's just going to be the machine. There's not going to humans anymore, at least from the way that I read the ending of this movie. It seems to be very pessimistic and kind of states that humans are going to just kind of work themselves out of the equation. And I think there is kind of that fatalistic attitude about Nathan throughout this movie, especially that talk they have by the waterfall, I guess, when he says, you know, someone was going to do it. It's just,
yeah.
Might as well be me. He doesn't seem to be optimistic or even proud about this project at all. He just wants to be the one to do it. Like, it seems like this race to the bottom, and he just wants to win the race regardless of which direction that race is running, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Cool. So what else did you like? But like, well, you said you really liked the, you said he's obviously a very talented director. What kind of really took you aback?
Well, did you notice anything about the use of lines in this movie, like visual lines throughout and setups?
No, I was, it's all color for me.
Okay. Well, that was the thing that I really found really fascinating, that with very few exceptions in this movie, if you see a wide shot with two people in the frame, be it Ava and Caleb, or Caleb and Nathan, or Caleb watching Nathan and Ava, there's always some sort of visual line in between them. Ava is in basically a clear prison every time that Nathan is, or sorry, Caleb is talking to her. And very often the center of the frame is just that, is just the line of her, cage, shall we say, just pointing directly at the camera. So giving this very obvious line in between the two of them. Caleb and Nathan even rarely, despite the fact that there are fewer barriers between them visually, like physically, there are just as many visual barriers. Like there are very frequently lines placed between Caleb and Nathan when they're on screen at the same time. And the only times when they kind of cross these lines, when one character crosses the line, is when they are very obviously coming to, they're both thinking of the same thing at the same time. Like that scene where Nathan takes Caleb to show him the Jackson Pollock painting. And he asks him the question. I forget what the question was, but I think it's something along the lines of, if Pollock didn't use his instinct, would he be able to paint this Pollock painting? And Caleb gives him the answer that Nathan wanted, the answer that Nathan was thinking. And in this scene, Caleb and Nathan are standing maybe 3 feet from each other, facing each other, but Caleb is on a different surface. He's on like carpet or something, and Nathan's on hardwood because the room just kind of splits and there's different lighting over Nathan than there is over Caleb. But when Caleb answers the question and answers it correctly is when Nathan puts his hand on Caleb's shoulder or something, like signifying that they are kind of together sometimes. And it's really interesting watching this movie and thinking about when characters cross over lines, which is very frequent. We only see Caleb and Ava in a barrier-free world together one time for maybe 5 seconds, and Caleb and Nathan only two or three times over the course of the movie. And it's really, really fascinating. And also when Ava finally becomes as close to human as we see her get in the film, the way lines are used to show that as well. It was great.
Yeah, no, it reminded me of Silence of the Lambs. Like, I just thought that it was so well put together. Just the things like that you were describing, just so much visual storytelling that wasn't just a huge, painfully obvious visual metaphor, but just the way that, the screen functions, it's just a piece of storytelling, like just, by the geography, things like that. I think there's a ton of that in the discussions between Caleb and Ava. It's usually immediately after it says the session number, like it'll say Ava's session 6 or whatever. There's some really interesting cinematography in there. Like, you touched on the fact that they are just divided for much of it, which shows that there just is that division between them, as two kinds of different beings. They just aren't going to be able to relate to each other perfectly. But we kind of get this slow progression of, as they do get closer. I mean, the first few sessions when we meet or when Caleb meets Ava, at least, she's very much, a test subject. Every time we see her with glass in the way. We get pretty clear shots of Caleb, without glass in the way, and he's free to move, and she's very much kind of this test subject, something to be studied, something literally to be looked at under glass. And we kind of slowly get this shift as they start to get to know each other better, or she becomes better able to, as we later learn, manipulate Caleb. And they do this by, having the glass in between them like that, having those lines right down the center of the screen. But as they get closer, to each other emotionally, I guess, things start to change, and we start seeing Caleb through glass now. As you know, he's the one kind of being interrogated. He's the one that's she is learning, and as we find out by the end, she's kind of just learning things about him in order to manipulate him. And we get that kind of from the side of the screen too. It used to be that Ava was always on the left side with Caleb on the right, but as soon as the power dynamics kind of switch, those start switching back and forth much more frequently too, and it's kind of just hard to tell who's interviewing who. And especially when Caleb's talking about his parents' death, that seems to be very obviously something very emotional and powerful for him. And at that time, he's the one who's sitting down. He's the one being seen through glass. He's the one the camera's looking down on. And so the power dynamic has shifted that now he's the one having to answer questions, and he's the one getting interviewed instead of performing this Turing test on her. Mm-hmm. And you know, during a lot of those moments, we kind of just get slow zooms. And that'll even happen with Caleb and Nathan. Anytime it seems to like they're coming to some kind of understanding, well, not any time, but often when they're coming to some understanding or learning something about each other, we kind of get these slow zooms onto everyone's face. And I said that fourth session is where the power dynamic kind of switches. We get seven of these sessions. The fourth one is the one right in the middle. And it's a very significant turning point. And as I said, it seems you can't really tell who's interviewing who by that point. And there's a really fascinating shot that it's a really short shot that I only noticed the second time watching it, kind of after thinking about these power dynamics and the slow zooms as more information is revealed about these characters. And right after it says Ava session five, we just get this slow zoom down a hallway on nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's really the only time I think we get this shot. Every other time it says the session, and then we cut right into the room. This one we get, you know, that title card, whatever, that says session five, and then we're just zooming on nothing. And at that point, everything after the fourth session, no one's really getting to know anybody anymore. Ava's really in charge and is now just manipulating Caleb. At that point, she knows enough about Caleb to manipulate him. She's not getting any closer to him. And on the other side of the coin, Caleb's not getting any closer to Ava. And she doesn't want him to. She wants him to feel like he is. She wants to develop this emotional, sexual kind of relationship between them, but it's not about getting to know her. It's about kind of putting on a show for him to fall, I guess, in love with her even more. And I just really love that transition after the fourth session, that the power dynamic has changed to the point where no useful information is being gained anymore. No one is truly getting to know the other one any further. Mm-hmm. Just planning ways to manipulate them. Caleb wants to be with her for you know, his reasons, and she wants to trick Caleb into you know, letting her out. And in the end, it was Ava that won and kind of got her way and was able to escape, while the other two get trapped inside this compound for I don't know how long. Well, Nathan's dead, but Caleb trapped inside.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned you liked a lot about the way colors are used in the movie. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. There's a ton of stuff. I mean, there's five prominent colors, I would say. We get blue, red, green, white, and black, pretty much. There's some gray in there, too. Caleb is basically, his color is pretty much blue, and blue in this movie kind of often represents tranquility and peace, and actually I think like a proper interpersonal relationship. Mm-hmm. And that also seems to be Ava's color when we meet her. You know, she's got that blue light inside. And then we also have red kind of represents, you know, what it often represents, you know, like anger or fear or power, things like that. And as Ava, you know, I think in her process of seducing Caleb, tries to dress like him, you know, the first thing she wears is a blue floral dress. And, you know, he seems to be very interested in that. And that is the first time she talks about how attracted he is to her. And that, you know, she's picking it up through the micro expressions and things like that. but it's not entirely blue dress. There are like the little bits of red. So she's kind of mimicking Caleb in a way to try to seduce him and win him over, but she can't hide certain things about her. And I think red is this kind of the selfish part of her, the part of her that is just purely robotic, that doesn't really value human communication or human relationships, that can't further her goals. And so we see her attempts to mimic him in an attempt to build that relationship, but she can't even hide this red, the true nature of who she is, the real red that I think presides in her mind. And, you know, there's tons of uses of blue and red together as kind of a human versus robotic juxtaposition. And I think one of the most interesting one is when Caleb is kind of losing in mind and he's questioning whether or not he's human. And, you know, he cuts his arm and he's looking in the mirror and like checking his mouth to see if he's a robot or a human being. He's wearing a blue and red striped shirt, and it's kind of the two things at once. He can't even make up his mind. He's not sure, you know, even who he is at that point. And I think that's a really interesting one. It's just a pinstripe shirt. You can barely make out the colors unless you look closely. But I think there's just some very, very interesting, deliberate choices of color in there. And even among that, you know, the discussion that Ava has with him, with Caleb, when she's asking his favorite color and he says red, you know, just to pick a color. And she says, no, it's not. And he, you know, he's not red, you know, and who he is as this human. And she sees that. She sees that right away, and she knows he's lying. And as we kind of delve more into that story, and he tells about his earliest memory being his mother's voice and just the color blue, you know, that's such a human, you know, combination of ideas, like this idea of being with your mother, this idea of seeing this blue sky, this peaceful, natural thing, and those things combining in your mind, and how that is, that's who Caleb is. Caleb is humanity in this movie, I feel. And you know, there's, and I think that's very much represented through blue often. And Nathan is the darker side of humanity, and kind of the more power hungry and egotistical and flawed side of humanity. And that's why we see him dressing in black a lot, mostly in black. Yeah. And the few times it seems when he is trying to distance himself from that, he wears white, and it's kind of this, you know, this black and white duality. He's a very capable man. He's very driven and very, you know, powerful and successful. But I think he's just held back by, you know, his ego. And as I said before, when talking about that race to the bottom, he's just not very forward thinking. For all his intelligence, he's less concerned about what is actually going to result out of this, and not whether or not he can do it. And so sometimes when he drinks too much and gets in recovery mode, he dresses in white. Sometimes when he actually relates to Caleb, he's got gray on. As you said, that scene where they go and check out, you know, all the parts and the wetware and things like that. He's wearing gray, and it seems to be that's the one time where the godliness black and the pure white come together and form this kind of a gray, but it can't last. And, you know, when he dresses in white to try to get away from his true nature, you know, and detox and drink vitamin water and eat brown rice and things like that. He, you know, he escapes it for a moment, but I think just deep down to the core, black is his color, and it's, you know, that power hungry, egotistical side of him that at times he wants to escape, but is just who he is to the core, and leads to his downfall in the end. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
yeah. No.
Did you notice any colors?
No, nothing outside of what you already pointed out. The blue and red thing was the thing I noticed the most, but certainly not to the extent that you elaborated on. So yeah, no, I another interesting thing in an interesting movie filled with interesting things.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and in the dance sequence as well, which that seems to be a time that humans and robots are actually in sync. You know, their dance number is very mm-hmm. well choreographed and timed out. And, you know, we have the red and blue background of the lighting on the wall, showing kind of humanity and, you know, the robotic. And he and Kyoko, he's wearing black and she's wearing white. So we have kind of this good and bad, and we have the human and robotic side all kind of mixed together in this one very weird, short little dance sequence. Yeah. And it's, it does so many things at once because of all those dualities I was just discussing. But, you know, it's fun and playful because, like, they're dancing to this music, and that should be, like, a fun, relaxing, wholesome thing. But we also know she's his robotic sex slave that he does not treat very well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of have all these, like, this fun, light thing, but we also have, there's so many dark undercurrents to it. I mean, he is going to break her jaw later, like, shortly after that in the mm-hmm. movie.
Like, break her jaw clean off.
And, you know, we later on... Yeah, oh, exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. Break her head by removing her jaw. Yeah, so that's just a really, really interesting scene to me, especially when you watch it through the second time and you know everything that's going on, because you have this fun music and this fun dance sequence, but then you know the dark truth about the relationship between the two of them, and you have Caleb kind of watching on in, I don't even know, like, fear and disgust and confusion. So it's this really great moment of all these kind of dualities butting up against each other. With some good choreography, so
yeah, and it's also incredibly funny. That's the added bonus for that scene. I described my reaction to that scene to a friend as a full-on guffaw. Like, I just love that scene so much. It's so funny. Oh, Oscar Isaac!
Oh, it's so good. And as I said, yeah. There's like five good parts, and there's five funny parts in this movie, and they all are hilarious.
Yeah.
Like Dan Aykroyd getting oral sex from a ghost.
I mean, so good. Like the idea of the drunken guy just asking who you're going to call and be like, hey, Ghostbusters, you know, that's funny. And then he's like, you don't know what Ghostbusters is? And then throwing in just a deep cut Ghostbusters reference, making just all made me so happy.
Yeah, that's funny with any movie, but I knew with Ghostbusters it would be closer to your heart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you kind of like for a reference like that, it feels like you have to pick this really like this cultural phenomenon type of movie. Like, it has to be a big movie to do like that. And also the who you're gonna call thing just kind of lines up. Yeah. Anyway, doesn't matter. We're overanalyzing the part of this movie that does not require that. So.
I know, but it's also another one of those times of just dualities. Like, he is so uncomfortable, and it's such like a dark, tense moment. Mm-hmm. And there's this oral sex joke from a ghost in the middle of it. But a lot of this movie is very unsettling, and that's one where it's such a funny line, it's such a good joke, but there's just an unease that's pervasive through this entire film that just kind of speaks to that idea of dualities again.
Yes.
Did you notice the use of reflections as well in this movie?
I don't think so. No, I can't think of anything.
Okay, there's one. It's kind of a graphic match that I really like, but as Caleb and Ava are, you know, kind of interviewing each other, and I think it's a point where it's one of the early sessions, but they're still they've started to really get to know each other. She kind of walks. Kind of around a corner, like she's still in her box, but she's kind of walked past it, just one of the walls, the glass walls, just by the way that the camera is. Mm-hmm. And we kind of see her face do a bit of a graphic match with Caleb's face, and it seems to be a moment of kind of genuine connection between the two. I mean, mm-hmm. now that we know what happened, maybe that was just part of her scheme, but it seems to be a nice moment of them actually kind of getting along, and it's just, you know, lining their faces up in the exact same part of the frame. I think it's that across without having to overstate it.
Yeah,
and I mean, so much of this movie is just about self-realization. Mm-hmm. Not so much with Nathan, because I think that's his downfall, is that he doesn't change throughout this movie.
Yeah,
he's the exact
sure.
same person at the start of this movie as he is at the end, except more dead. but I mean, that's, he doesn't change because, you know, he is the villain. He's not supposed to. He is the kind of the negative force in all this. He's the antagonist that, you know, creates Frankenstein's monster and lets it possibly destroy civilization.
Exactly. He views himself as the man that doesn't need to change. He's the one that creates change for the world, and that the world has to adapt to him. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's obviously a very negative force for society overall. But we get Caleb learning maybe not so much about himself, but at least his place in this weird setup that he won a contest into / didn't really.
yeah.
He discovers a bit about who he is and why he's there. Family, but he's still smart enough. And, you know, I think the last third of this movie starts with Caleb understanding that he was kind of the subject of a reverse Turing test this whole movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much a test. The real test wasn't if a human can determine what's a machine, but can a human care about a machine? And I think in that way, that was kind of Nathan's test about the power of what he created, is if he could get someone to love it in a way. You know, like Caleb, you know, obviously at least would have lost his job because of what happens, you know, when he tries to get him drunk and, you know, recode all these things and escape with Ava, and probably a lot worse than just getting fired.
Yeah, it seems like he is hanging out with or betraying one of the richest people that exists, you know, so I would imagine some dark things are in Caleb's future. So maybe
he's very rich, very powerful, has dropped some jokes about killing people who he didn't trust with a secret in the past. Yeah. Very quick to anger. Yeah, not a guy you'd want to upset. And your boss. Also someone just you wouldn't want to upset.
And he lifts a lot of weight.
But so he really... yeah, obviously.
And we see that he can throw a punch by the end of the film.
Facts, yes. And so Caleb, you know, puts himself on the line for, you know, what is essentially just a very glamorized computer. And I think that was the nature of Nathan's real test, wasn't to see how Caleb would treat this artificial intelligence as a machine, but whether or not it could kind of transcend and to be cared about emotionally as a human, not just trick him intellectually into being believing she was a human.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of his dark realization for the final act of this movie. But obviously more central to this is Ava's journey of self-realization. You know, as I said at the beginning of those sessions, she's very much a test subject, kind of looking at being looked at through glass. And then as she kind of sees a bit more of herself and Caleb and kind of finds what she feels to be some human elements within her, I guess, we get that translucent semi-reflection in the glass that I was talking about.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once she's killed Nathan and she finds her way to, you know, the prototype room, she understands who she is and she sees that full reflection of her in the mirror and she kind of sees her full body for the first time as a reflection. And most importantly at that point, and I think the kind of the completion of her journey, is she makes eye contact with herself. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, that's it for her. That's her journey there. That's her arc.
And
it's not a super positive one, I believe. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah. One of the things I like about that scene is that I talked about the way lines are used in this movie as being very interesting to me. And as she's putting skin, I guess I'll call it, on herself and attaching the other robot's arm to replace her arm that is no longer there, as she's doing all that and the mirror is moving in the frame, I believe she's kind of like slowly moving the mirror or closing one of the closet doors or something, and this line sort of goes across her as we're, you know, framed as a mid shot basically, and we see the lines on her skin like sort of disappearing as it sort of links together, whatever you would call what is happening, as she's becoming more of a human, the lines on her are disappearing as this mirror line is crossing over her body. And what we end up with is far and away the most human Ava's ever looked. And it's the shot you're talking about where she is naked and looks at herself and sees herself for the first time. And sees herself as close to human as we see her get. And and I think that's just another interesting way that this movie shows lines in general. And also the disappearance of lines and when something crosses over a line. And that's where Ava kind of believes that, potentially believes that she has crossed over the only line she cares about crossing over. It's very interesting. And lines are cool.
Yeah, she just wants to fool people. And yeah. I think, as you said, like when she sees herself in this way, she... has crossed that last line for her, and that she feels like her intelligence has always been there, but she her dealings with Caleb is, can I fool enough people? Can I manipulate people in such a way that they will always believe that they'll believe I'm a human? If they don't believe I'm a human, they'll care about me enough to treat me like one anyway. Mm-hmm. But that room you were describing, with kind of the circular room with the mirrors there, there's another shot that I really like where some of the doors are open and we see those old prototypes, and Kyoko stands up and she's in one of those mirrors now from mm-hmm. the way that the shot is. And so she just looks like another one of the robots in the lineup. And it's right before it is revealed she's a robot. Mm-hmm. I kind of had that inkling for a little bit anyway,
yeah.
But I think it's, I do like that there's that mystery there. And I do think that's a really cool shot that it's kind of told through cinematography before it's told through dialogue, or at least, plain action of her. I think the first thing she does is kind of rip some skin off her face that makes it 100% clear that she's a robot. But I thought that was a nice little piece of visual storytelling that, it's only a few seconds or minutes ahead of, when everyone would figure it out. But I think if you watch this movie through a lens like that, you can see kind of these interesting ideas, or these kind of foreshadowing situations that are just around the corner anyway, but it just shows how much thought was put into it.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about where Caleb kind of realizes that he has been deceived, and that's one of the things I really enjoy about this movie is and it's kind of this idea that runs throughout, right? Especially as we see that Caleb starts to distrust Nathan and begins actively plotting against Nathan to get Ava out of the compound, shall we call it. And it's really interesting that all throughout this movie, we see Caleb blindly trust technology, but be very skeptical of Nathan. And I think that's something that this movie that runs throughout this movie that's very interesting, and that I definitely see in reality, is that we have learned how to distrust humans. Like, we understand that humans are nefarious, like, we get that. It's not something that surprises us whenever a human does something terrible, we understand that that's a possibility. And with technology, very often you see people just sort of embrace technology and trust that they will always be in control of it, not unlike Nathan kind of assumes he will be in control of it, which eventually leads to his downfall. And I thought that was really interesting. And the whole movie basically hinges on Caleb never thinking for a second that technology would betray him. And he sees it as this pure thing that can do no wrong and is under human control. And it just turns out that that's not the case. And I find that even, outside of the dramatic turn that happens there, the turn in the idea itself is very interesting and very, very cool to me.
Yeah, and there's a couple ways it works in too. It's kind of just a throwaway line, but mm-hmm. the way that Ava got all her skills at communicating with people was through that cell phone hack, and that they just turned on all the microphones and cameras on every phone in, quote, the entire fucking world.
Yeah, they turned on the Batman finds the Joker device.
Yes.
Lucius didn't properly shut it down.
Yeah. I mean, it's something. I mean, that's in one of the Avengers too, or one of those Marvel movies. But that's a trope we're seeing more and more often is this idea that all the cameras are on and recording all the time, and someone is doing it. And you know, just to go to your point, you know, it's never really stated that it's a bad idea that we're carrying around recording and tracking equipment all the time. It's just there's going to be one bad person who does something with it. Mm-hmm. And he kind of says, you know, the companies couldn't accuse me of doing it without admitting it, that they're doing it themselves. I think that, you know, there is kind of the fear of, you know, not technology, but what humans are going to do to it. And it's mm-hmm. like, I think that that's part of this movie too, is that, you know, when Nathan acts like this, when Nathan is so short-sighted about robotics, that's when it gets out of control. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of the Frankenstein's monster trope once again, that it's human error and it's human short-sightedness that's going to let, you know, technology run rampant and Ava out and to do whatever damage she chooses to do on the world.
Yeah, exactly. It's all unintended consequences, basically. Like, you know, any technology is sort of created to give you control over something, right? Like a hammer was created to give you power over nails, you know, but that hammer can also be used as a crude murder weapon. I don't know a lot about the invention of the hammer, but I assume it was designed to build houses first and murder people second. But there's always that unintended consequence, right, of anything. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about this movie in the ending is that we get a lot of talk about instinct and, you know, there's the most notably that conversation between Nathan and Caleb after the first time Caleb meets Ava. And basically Caleb just like, no, I just want to have a beer and talk to you. I don't want to have a seminar. Like, how did Ava make you feel? Like what? And it basically comes down to something that's barely more than a primal review of the conversation he had with Ava, and that it's, I believe Caleb says that it was fucking awesome. And that's like Nathan basically wants to get away from the more intellectual thoughts behind what lead to Ava, and he just wants to know how Ava makes you feel, right? And that he just wants that instinct and feeling, that the thing that he's talking about with the Pollock, he wants that in what he creates as well, without thinking about what might come next, you know? And I think that that's what the purpose that, and like I said, like technology is all about creating control, like hammers creating control over nails. And basically every new technology gives you control over something new, but you don't have control over everything ever. Like, you never will. And I think that's the purpose that alcohol serves in the movie. And it's the purpose of the scene where they're having sushi, where Nathan and Caleb are having sushi. And after Kyoko spills wine on Caleb, Nathan says something along the lines of, no matter how rich you get, shit still breaks, you know? And there are just always going to be some things that you can't control. And even this guy that has all the money anybody could ever want and seems to want for nothing, even there are even some things that are outside of his control, including things that he has created, you know, things that he started and finished and made all of the, you know, decisions in between. And even that is out of his control because Ava gets free, you know?
Yeah, and Nathan explicitly says one time, you know, it's Promethean. He's talking about the way that he, you know, has created these things. This might be the artificial intelligence. This might be the next, I think he says, you know, the biggest invention in the history of mankind or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, quick mythology lesson. Promethean was the Greek titan that delivered fire to humans, and as his punishment from the gods, he was chained to a rock and had his liver pecked out by an eagle every morning. Mm-hmm. I enjoy very much that Nathan is very mean to his liver throughout this entire movie. Yeah, yeah. And that at the end Ava stabs him and Mm-hmm. And, you know, kills the job, finishes the job. But just to get to your point of what you're saying about not ever being able to have control. It's, I think, you know, the gods in this mythology like this just, aren't real personified people, but are just, you know, the inevitability of what's going to happen. If we think we can have control like that, we're going to be punished the way that Nathan is very clearly punished by the end of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't remember if I mentioned this already, but that in the very ending, we get that cut back to the Pollock just before Ava leaves. And it's kind of like, this is where instinct and feeling have left you, you know, dead and bleeding from the liver.
Yeah. What did you think of those black and white scenes?
I will say I didn't put a lot of thought into them, but Caleb kind of explains what they are, right? Like that the robot doesn't see color until it gets out of the world or something like that. I don't totally remember the scene all that well either.
Oh yeah, Mary in the colored room.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know. I thought you might they might bother you more, as it's kind of something that, as you said, Caleb does explain, and then we get the shots of it, and it's I thought it was pretty on the nose, but I didn't know if you had an idea of who was picturing them, or if that's kind of Ava's dreams or her thoughts, I guess, because we do see some of Ava and Caleb coexisting outside of the compound where she's obviously never been. And I didn't know if that you thought it was kind of her vision or what your take on that was.
Yeah, I guess I didn't really think about it that much because it is kind of on the nose. It is kind of just, it's the movie showing. I don't think for a second that, you know, obviously you're not supposed to think it's something that happens. You're supposed to think it's somebody's vision. I guess I didn't think about it because it was so on the nose, you know, that it was just an image being described while I looked at that image. And there were just so many interesting things going on in this movie that was one thing I just kind of ignored, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you think Ava meant when she said she's one? It kind of gets, repeated and then moved on from.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Because of course, anytime something like that is repeated in a movie that's as tightly scripted as this, it means something, you know, and like capital S something. I don't know. I don't know what it means. And I don't have a reading on it. It was basically like the closest thing I have to a reading is basically a list of the ways we denote time, you know, like minute, day, hour, year, you know. So there's, I don't have any deep reading beyond a list of things, you know.
A list of increments of time.
Yeah, exactly, passage. Exactly. And not even in the proper order. I think I said it. Yeah, before hour.
Yeah, I mean, after that, I thought, you know, like model 1.0, you know what,
yeah,
I mean?
That was,
like, I'm,
yeah,
one. I'm kind of the beginning, the end. I think that there's, something to be said about Ava's name being so similar to Eve, mm-hmm, you know, for being kind of the first, being a female.
Hey, that's a name thing I got.
There you go. I also just like that her name is so symmetrical and can be flipped upside down.
Oh, yeah.
Super cool in a robotic computer kind of way. Yeah. But yeah, I just thought of it more like model 1.0, and that's like she's the beginning, and that's, you know, there is no real passage of time for her. It's just, this is it. You know, just the way that, when they're talking about language being an acquired skill and the fact that she's always learned to talk as being weird or being something difficult for Caleb to understand, or something that she even seemed kind of almost embarrassed about or something, just because she knew it was so unnatural. Just to think about her as the beginning, and then when we know who her creator was, everything we know about Nathan and the way his ego seems to work, and that he's clearly, you know, an alpha male. Like, he clearly thinks he is very important. He's, you know, he's the beginning of this next phase in humanity, or, you know, the last phase of humanity, but he doesn't care because he was important. You know, if she's so proud, if she's kind of hooked on the fact that she's, you know, the beginning of this next step, I think Nathan is very much the end of the previous step, in that, you know, she's the next incarnation. You know, she is one, she's the next one. But Nathan is like, he's kind of the Zeta, the last thing to that 11 or Omega, I guess, the last thing in this kind of chapter of humanity.
Yeah, no, I can see that. And yeah, I and again, I don't have a different reading, so I mean, I have no counterpoint. So
yeah, that's all right. What did you like that upside down shot on the street corner at the end? Or like, what's your take of the very ending of this movie?
It's amazing. The end of this movie is so good. it's so wonderful, right? Because we have that intro that I already said a lot about, that I like so much. It's so concise, it's so beautiful, and just so well put together, and even just ends like for the last second of that, before we get that shot of outside of the helicopter flying with Caleb in it, we get a shot of Caleb quickly looking into the camera like, oh my god, this is happening. He's got his golden ticket to Willy Wonka's factory and everybody's congratulating him for it. And it's seen as this really, really positive thing, right? He is in this world with a lot of people, and he is able to, he gets this thing that everybody in that world seems to desire. Now, I don't, whether or not this is a more, as popular outside of Long Island or wherever he says he lives, as it might be, you know, inside the programming world where he actually works. We don't know. We just see him in his office, and it's this thing that seems to be like the most momentous thing that could happen to him on a given work day. And and people celebrate him as such. And he gets all these texts from people like Lauren Lapkus and other various names of people. And then he just goes off, right? And he goes from this large world that is very congratulatory to him to this small world where he has to kind of figure out this place that he's in. And what we see at the end is kind of Ava doing the opposite, leaving this small world that she feels imprisoned by, and the only thing she wants is to get out of it. The golden ticket for her is to just get out and get to the outside. And what we see in the closing seconds of this movie is the counterpoint to the intro. And we see kind of the same thing. We see one of our characters leaving the only place, or the place that they spend the most time, in Ava's case, the only place she has ever spent her time, and see them see this place that they've always dreamed about, or dreamed about for some time. And what's beautiful about that sequence with Ava is that there are lines all through the sidewalk, and all of the shadows are just crossing over them willy-nilly. It's kind of like what we talked about with unintended consequences. Like, once you get into society, the lines are just gone. Like, it's once you let go of something you've created, you can never control how it's used. And what Ava is about to do is prove that point. Whatever she does, it proves that point, because Nathan has no control over Ava anymore. And what she does is she becomes a face in the crowd. She becomes what she wants to so badly. And then the movie just ends. And that's the closing point of the movie, is that no matter how much thought you put into something that you create, this technology you create, it will always, once it's out of your hands, those decisions cease to be up to you. You know, like somebody, even if it's just something like an iPhone, somebody figures out an interesting app to use on it that you never could have intended, you know, and whether or not that app is a net positive or negative for society, doesn't matter. Steve Jobs has no control over it, you know, for reasons outside of the fact that he's dead, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's, we just have her kind of standing still. And as you said, like, the shadows just kind of crossing over her, like, she's this thing, she is what she is. And now humanity is going to do whatever humanity does with it. Like, you're thrown in the middle of society. She just wanted to be at a busy intersection. Like, sure, people are going to think different things of you. People are going to use whatever it is in different ways. It's kind of just thrown into the middle of humanity and things are out of control. And it's skewed. Like it's the camera's upside down. Like it's not what we intended. It's not, it could never look the way that we thought it was going to look or be used the way that we thought it was going to be used. It's in the middle of humanity doing whatever they want to it. And of course, we were wrong about what it was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Because we always are. Like, there's
you got
always
anything else on Ex Machina?
I feel like we should address the gender issue just briefly, if at all, sure. Because it seems to be, it's the thing that you that is a negative about this movie. That's kind of weird and certainly problematic. And even just for the fact that there is a scene in this movie where Caleb looks into a screen and watches Ava undress, you know, like whether or not she's a robot, that's still kind of creepy. And this is something that has been brought up to Alex Garland a lot. And it was something that I mean, Kyoko is a really easy way to just see it be kind of gross because of just the way Kyoko is treated throughout this movie. This is something that's been brought up to Alex Garland a lot, and he doesn't have a really solid answer for it. The best answer. It's so present that I feel like I didn't even need to give details, but details are, it's two men, talking about a caged woman for the entirety of the movie. And the only woman out of a cage, in this movie is Kyoko, who's treated like Kyoko. And, the best answer, Alex Garland gave for, why it shouldn't be a problem is kind of, I think the best answer to most of these problems is, he said, well, what happens if you switch the genders, right? Caleb and Nathan become women and, Ava becomes a man. And then he says it becomes sort of a misogynistic movie and maybe kind of seems like something a men's rights activist would be very into, because you get, two interesting female characters, assuming very few of their lines change, and then they are killed by the man that frees himself from the grasp of the woman, right? And it's kind of one of the things I always think of is the Matrix race switch, right? Like Neo was, I believe the first option for the Wachowskis was Will Smith as Neo and Sean Connery as Morpheus, right? And then it becomes, as opposed to the, and pardon my language with this, the magic Negro teaching the white Jesus how to save the world with Lawrence Fishburne and Keanu Reeves, it becomes the white man with wisdom teaching the black man how to save the world, right? So there's something always problematic in these types of things. And the only way to kind of accept it is sometimes you have to give up. Like, sometimes things have to be bad in a movie for other things to be good. And I think the problem only really comes when the movie itself isn't super interesting in a variety of other ways, which I think Ex Machina is. And I think the way this movie treats gender is certainly problematic. But if I have to deal with problematic gender to get all the interesting stuff about technology, then I think it's worth it, you know? And maybe that's part of the problem because, you know, I'm spending all this time thinking about unintended consequences of technology, right? Like a technology that I'm describing could seem good to me, you know, and then I don't think of the actual problem with it. Like this movie in existence with its gender problem is still good to me, but I don't think about how it affects the world once it gets out there. But like this movie, I have no hard answer, you know, like it's just something to think about. And I felt like it deserved to be mentioned, even though I don't think it devalues the movie at all, because I think this is a really good movie. And the only reason people are talking about the problem with it is because it's so well thought out otherwise. You know, and I'm certain there is some thought behind gender in this movie as well, but it's just not brought to the forefront. And it ends up being problematic. But if the option is Ex Machina doesn't exist or Ex Machina exists with gender problems, I'll take the Ex Machina that exists.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Then you have it, sir.
Yeah, exactly. I have it. The patriarchy wins again, I guess. Yeah, but thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, and check back next week. All right, thanks.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.